Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I need you to pay close attention to this message. It is not an ad. This is about Canada Land, and this is about you. You need to know that the news crisis is about to get a lot worse. You've heard about the layoffs. We're about to have news closures, and it's very likely that we're going to be seeing the defunding of the CBC. Where are you going to get your information from? What can you do about this? You can support Canada Land. We need you to. And so for this month and this month only, you can become a Canada Land supporter and get everything our supporters get for just $2 a month. That is an almost 80% discount. The clock is ticking on this. It disappears at the end of the month, and then we will not offer it. We need your support. We need to keep news coverage alive in Canada. Go right now to canadaland.com/join. And thank you. This episode of Canada Land is brought to you by Douglas, a mattress that is trusted by more than 200,000 Canadians from coast to coast to coast. It's a great mattress at a very reasonable price point. Comes with a 20-year warranty. And a great deal for our listeners. Douglas is giving you a free sleep bundle with each mattress purchase. Get the sheets, pillows, mattress, and pillow protectors free with your Douglas purchase today. Visit douglas.ca/CanadaLand to claim this offer. That is douglas.ca/CanadaLand. A journalistic disaster zone. That is what a Senate commission called New Brunswick when they were investigating media monopolization. Why would they describe the province that way? Because of the Irving family. If you have never heard of the Irving family, then the Irving family is pretty happy about that. They are a low-key family, despite the fact that they are the third wealthiest family in Canada. They are billionaires. They are the fifth largest private landowner in the U.S. Their empire spans energy, forestry, trucking, construction, real estate, and media. They basically own the print media in New Brunswick, and they run their media monopoly like no other press baron family you've heard of. At one point, they seriously suggested that their newsroom staff all wear uniforms like the employees at their gas stations, as it would be sort of a morale-building, team-building exercise. That plan never came to fruition, but I think it gives you a little bit of an idea of how they operate. But the truth is, it's very hard to get a bigger picture of how they operate because, as I mentioned, they are very low-key, they are very private, their holdings are private, they don't have to disclose anything to shareholders, and they have been, for decades, for generations of Irvings, kind of impenetrable to journalists. They don't really give a lot of access. But that has not stopped journalist and author Jacques Poitras from thoroughly researching and investigating the Irvings for his book, Irving versus Irving. He got limited access to some of the family before they cut him off, but a lot of his knowledge of the family comes from the fact that he worked at an Irving family newspaper, the St. John Telegraph Journal, for 6 years. These days, he is the provincial affairs reporter for CBC News in New Brunswick, and Jacques Poitras will join me in a moment. This episode of Canada Land is brought to you by Dan McRoberts, Steve Bedard, Brady Gunderson, Sarah Lazarevic, Brandon Carroll, Craig D. Adams, Jane Litvinenko, Daryl Bratton, Steve Perificati, Matt Abbott, and James Thorburn. James, why did you decide to be awesome?
With critical honesty, inside information, and the obvious necessity to book guests whom no one else will let on the air, Canada Land has earned my support and continues to deliver.
This episode is brought to you by Douglas, a mattress trusted by more than 200,000 Canadians from coast to coast to coast. Trust is important. There are a lot of mattress lies out there, a lot of mattress liars. And I didn't intend the pun, but it occurred to me that there is one as I was saying those words. Listen, I am not lying to you. I have experienced the Douglas mattress. It is an exceptional mattress at a surprisingly affordable price point. It is a mattress that sleeps cool, doesn't have that weird thing in the summer where the mattress gets like an oven. It's a very good product. It's delivered to your house in a box. You don't have to go to a big mattress store. It is a medium firm mattress, which is what Canadians prefer, and it comes with a 365-night trial and a 20-year warranty. What more can I tell you? Douglas is giving our listeners a free sleep bundle with each mattress purchase. Get the sheets, pillows, mattress, and pillow protectors free with your Douglas purchase today. Visit douglas.ca/CanadaLand to claim this offer. This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. It's amazing the things that we tell ourselves to talk ourselves out of getting help. Anybody who's actually gotten help knows that the process of getting things off your chest, of taking your stressors, your problems, and just like not letting them be bottled up, working through just conveying them to somebody, half of the battle is just doing that. You unburden yourself. And you know what? If you have a real mental health professional, no, they don't have magic bullets or magic words that make it all go away. But often they can help you see things a little bit differently and guide you to strategies or tools or to a new perspective that actually does help. As the largest online therapy provider in the world, BetterHelp can provide access to mental health professionals with a wide variety of expertise in mental health. Because you listen to this podcast, you get 10% off of your first month at betterhelp.com/CanadaLand. That's betterhelp.com/CanadaLand. I had no idea about any of this. I had no idea who the Irvings were. Is that just because I'm like a Toronto-centric?
Pretty much.
That's it? That's the reason? There are other reasons why you might not. This does not show up in a lot of Google rankings, these papers.
It doesn't show up in any Google rankings. No, it's paywalled to the max. Yeah, it's natural you would not hear of them. I mean, I can't think on a national scale of something that compares to what they own and influence on a provincial or regional scale.
Yeah. Their approach to the internet is, I mean, it seems like it is the most solid paywall I've read of. Like, no free articles.
Right. Yeah, no meter.
No meter.
No cap.
And no social media indexing at all.
No.
It's like North Korea. It's like the hermit province of New Brunswick.
I'm not going to go that far, but it is.
I've never read an article from. I read a lot of articles from Canadian newspapers. I've never read an article from these papers.
Well, it's not that expensive for a trial subscription. It's 99 cents. But no, now some of the reporters do tweet a bit. But what they generally tweet is, I mean, they've started loosening up on Twitter, but what they'll tweet is a link to the story. And so these tweets go out, and a lot of people, so when they come across one of the Twitter accounts for the first time, it's like, great, they click, and then they get the please log in with your account information page.
Uh-huh.
And that comes as a surprise. And of course, this became a big issue in June when the guy was on the loose in Moncton after shooting those cops. And people were going to the newspaper sites for basic information like, is the curfew lifted? Is it safe to go out on the street with this?
Is there a madman on my street shooting people?
Essentially.
Sorry, 99 cents for a free trial.
Yeah, essentially. And this caused a big stir in social media. Everyone was talking about this, and there was a back and forth debate about should they lift the paywall. As the New York Times has done for Hurricane Sandy.
Yeah, it's not without
right?
precedent.
They lift the paywall for 48 hours so people can get basic survival information.
Yeah.
And in this case, it's still not clear to me. I've heard differing things about whether they chose not to or whether the software that they use to run their paywall doesn't allow it, because the Irvings are pretty frugal and they would buy the least expensive. It's very feasible that they would – or conceivable they'd buy the least expensive and least flexible paywall app out there. And so, you know, to just sort of flick a switch and make it free may not actually be possible. That was one of the things that went around.
Yeah, whether deliberate or not, it sort of speaks to the basic public interest role of journalism. When shit like that goes down and you need information, You know, I mean, you can choose, I suppose. I mean, I guess you can make the parallel to newspapers. Even if you didn't subscribe, you could have gone and bought the newspaper that day, and I guess you could have bought the 99 cent. I mean, right. You're not going to fill
when
out
a guy's
form.
On the loose, when the guy's on the loose and there's a police manhunt with helicopters in the air waiting till 7 o'clock the next morning for the dead tree edition to land on your doorstep doesn't quite cut it. Now, the flip side of the argument, and I get the flip side of the argument, and I'm kind of agnostic on this. I really do see both sides of it, is it's a business. All media are going through this crisis these days of revenue and how are they going to monetize what they do. And there's dollar value to the news. I guess you could say it was real dollar value to the news at that moment. People wouldn't have thought 20 years ago about buying the newspaper the next morning to find out what was going on with this situation. So why not charge people for it? I mean, why suddenly give it away when it's in demand at the max?
Yeah, it's an interesting case because, you know, reading their approach to the internet and social media, you could either see them as the most obsolete dinosaurs out there, or you could say, hey, they've actually figured out a viable way to get people to pay for news. But that's
part of that's the circumstance that there are no other daily newspapers in the province that people can turn to for free.
So future of news, everybody who's listening who wanted to figure out how we're going to save this news business, eliminate every other newspaper or news organization.
Charge
what you want.
Problem solved.
Yeah, because that's the issue is everybody who considered putting up a paywall, the counter argument is like, look, if we make people pay for it, they're just going
to get
somebody
to the other
else.
Guy. Yeah.
In New Brunswick, there's no other guy.
There's the CBC, and so our website, you know, is there and it's free.
Yeah.
People are paying for it through their taxes, but no, in terms of newspapers, no, that's it.
It's interesting to hear that they're tweeting now because you know you write that they weren't allowed to tweet.
Originally. That's right. Yeah.
I mean, this is remarkable. I don't know if there's any other precedent in North America for a news market like this.
I don't think there is, and I don't think there's any precedent really for the level of influence in general. I mean, they're the biggest private sector employer in the province.
One in 10 people work for the Irvings?
Well, you hear 1 in 6, 1 in 8, 1 in 12. It's impossible to get a bead on it because they're so opaque. I mean, they don't have any shareholders to report to. But their refinery accounts for more than half of the province's exports. So they're big. The only comparison that – there's a couple of comparisons. You can think of John D. Rockefeller in the U.S.
Yeah.
Like 100-plus years ago.
That's what it evokes. It's like
owning industry, except he didn't own the media.
Yeah.
You can compare it to Pierre-Carl Péladeau in Quebec and his media holdings, but he doesn't also own all this industry. And there's competition for his media organizations in the Quebec market and with Quebec Or. So there really isn't a good comparison to sort of the industrial holdings plus the media holdings.
This is the second wealthiest family in Canada. They're making obscene fortunes from their energy. You would have a long time listing everything that they're involved in. Why are they in the newspaper business? Why do they care about media?
Well, you know, it began with Casey Irving, who was the founder of the empire, the companies in the 20s and 30s. And the consensus seems to be that he started buying up the newspapers because he didn't want anyone else coming into the market. Because if anyone else came into the market, they would be scrutinizing his companies. So the general view is that that was his goal, to buy up any media organization that might scrutinize him. And he also bought a TV station, a radio station. Now, in the 70s and 80s, the story is his three sons were so spooked by the two federal investigations and the attempted prosecution that they really did not know what to do with these newspapers. They didn't want to sell them, but they were scared that the federal government would regulate newspaper ownership at one point if they stepped out of line. So they really did step back and not meddle in them. I believe that. But that didn't necessarily mean they were doing good journalism, because then they had editors and publishers who were kind of not disposed to crusading investigative journalism in place. And so, you know, the newspapers were kind of average and still didn't really scrutinize the Irving companies. So it was kind of the same net effect in the end.
I think this is an important point, because when we talk about these incredibly wealthy owners of newspapers and you talk about influence, people always imagine that you've got, you know, the Thompson family picking up the phone or something like that. And that might happen on rare occasions. But the actual effect of having overlords like that is a bit subtler, isn't it? I mean, you know who's making decisions and you know where their interests lie, and that affects in an internalized way what you cover and how you cover it.
Yeah, there's a quote actually from a Globe and Mail article on the papers in the late 60s where it quotes one guy in the newsroom saying, let's be careful here, guys. We don't want the Irving boys coming down and interfering with the newsroom. So, I mean, that's it in a nutshell, right?
Yeah.
It's like it's preemptive or self-censorship,
yeah.
which is again, the net effect is kind of the same.
Well, we can look at this in practice. So how have these papers, you know, what's their track record in covering Irving family affairs when you've got this company that has such a prominent role in the province?
There's different phases and different approaches at different times. As I said, they were sort of hands off, but the publishers and editors were kind of not terribly enterprising for a long period of time. There would be periods where they would hire an editor who actually did feel that it was their role to go and scrutinize the company. So there was an editor for a couple of years in 89-90 who commissioned a big investigative series on pollution in the Bay of Fundy, and it really pointed the finger at the Irving companies. There was a big map that showed the pulp mill and the paper mill and how many tons of sludge were pouring out of them into the Bay of Fundy and all this, and that was very admirable. He eventually left. And then in the 90s, I worked there for a time. Neil Reynolds was there. Neil Reynolds was the one who decided to publish the story of Casey Irving's will and his offshore trust account on the front page. So, you know, things like that would happen. But depending on whether that editor stuck around or not, it wouldn't last, and there'd be a reversion to form and things like that. The illustration that I think best shows this problem right now is this splitting up of the companies. I mean, there's been this terrible internal dispute within the family that has led to the Irving empire being broken in two, essentially.
The patriarch died and then...
Yeah, and then there were disagreements between his sons and his grandchildren over, and there were things about the companies that were no longer compatible. So around 2005, 2006, they made a decision to disentangle everything. This brother would run these things, that brother would run those things. And this involved offshore trusts in Bermuda and hundreds of millions of dollars and everything. And none of it was in the newspapers.
Uh-huh.
Now, the average newsroom on an average day has to make all kinds of subjective decisions, like what are we going to cover today? You know, and maybe some reporters are sick and they're short-staffed and they don't get their calls returned. And, you know, you can overanalyze on a given day whether a particular story was in or the paper or not for a given reason. But over a period of 6 or 7 years, the largest corporate presence in the province transformed itself into two companies from one. And there was no analysis of this in the paper. There was no journalistic exploration. There was no look at who was running what companies. There was one little item that appeared the day after the Globe and Mail actually broke the story of the Irving split.
Uh-huh.
And it was, you know, Irving says it's business as usual. And that was it. And it was never, the story was never heard from again.
So what happens if you step into this market and say, okay, well, you know, there's a vacuum. You're not covering this stuff. It's of incredible urgent interest to people who work for these companies. So we're going to be the indie upstart. We're going to launch a new newspaper. How have they dealt with new entrants into the market?
Well, when it's had an impact on their market share, they've been, there was a Here magazine, which was an alternative weekly that started in St. John 2001. And it was started by a former Telegraph Journal reporter who just thought, you know, let's publish something for the young demographic, you know, not just listings, but and not just advertorial, but actual like coverage of City Hall, but with a youthful take.
It's alternative news weekly.
Yeah. So, yeah, your basic generic alt weekly.
Yeah.
And so he started it and it was doing all right. And then he decided to launch an edition in Moncton. And it was at that point that Brunswick News started a competing, quote unquote, alt weekly, and gobbled up a lot of the ad market. And all of a sudden, Here's numbers were declining fast. And they went looking for investors. And the guy who was running it has said in the past that no one wanted to invest in it because they knew that when the Irvings are sort of entering the arena against you, that it's a losing battle because of the depth of their resources, the depth of their money. So eventually they had to make the decision to sell the thing to the Irving newspaper company. And then Here became kind of a bland, generic listings, advertorial kind of product.
I mean, that's incredible. You know, looking at other papers in Canada and sort of talking with journalists about sort of the worst case scenario for what could happen when a paper is owned by, you know, interests, and usually they're these wealthy families. I mean, whether you look at the Thompsons, or if you look at the Irvings, or if you look, you know, the Post being started by Conrad Black, never in the portfolio as huge moneymakers, but as propaganda, either to directly report the interests and support the interests of its owners, or just to prevent other voices from getting out there. And that's all well and good, and you can do what you want in a free market. You can start a paper, you can charge what you want, you can say what you want in it. But when we can actually see the direct relationship of them keeping other media out, you know, there's a cautionary tale for everybody in that.
There are some interesting alt media things developing, bubbling up in New Brunswick, like anywhere else. There's a guy who's Charles Terrio, who puts videos analyzing the forestry industry online. There's in St. John, there's a zine now, an old analog zine published called Hard Times in the Maritimes, that looks at sort of people having a rough time in St. John,
like a photocopy zine.
And so there's other, there are other things going on, but they are. They are still the dominant force, for sure.
It's very hard to get a newsroom full of working journalists to kind of like march in lockstep. But even when you've got these editors sort of rebelling by doing a piece on them, that's still part of the narrative of like, I'm gonna demonstrate my independence.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, rhetorically, the Irvings will say, our companies are fair game. You cover them, and as long as you get it right. As long as the facts are right, that's fine, you know. And when we do something stupid, you know, give us a whack on the backside and that's fine. But when, you know, then the other hand, I interviewed Jim Irving and J.K. Irving, and he said during the interview, we don't want the guys down there raising hell.
Uh-huh.
And to other editors, he said, we don't want a maverick down there. We don't want a cowboy. We don't want we want a paper that's spicy but not hot. We're in business for New Brunswick, and we want, you know, the papers to be for New Brunswick. To me, I interpret that, and it's pretty explicit. They feel that the paper's roles is to support economic development and growth in the province.
Boosterism, cheerleading.
And Jamie Irving, who his son, who runs the papers directly, actually said in an interview, which I quote, you know, a newspaper can be a great cheerleader, can help everybody in the community get rowing in the same direction.
Uh-huh.
Okay, so that's fine. They're free to do that, but to me, when you hear that, then you wonder about the watchdog role. Because if you're trying to develop a consensus around a certain economic vision, which happens to be the economic vision of the owners and their industrial holdings, what does that mean for stepping back and being, you know, the checks and the balances in the system and the watchdog and asking the tough questions that have to be asked when that comes? I mean, I'm not sure how that is compatible with cheerleading or rowing in the same direction or being for New Brunswick as defined by the owner.
And even that is a bit disingenuous because, you know, though much of the censorship might be internalized, they're not above stepping in there in crucial moments, you know, as you document, when the paper endorsed the wrong candidate.
Yeah, that was an interesting episode. That was an interesting episode because I'm of two minds on that one. So this was in 1997. The editorial board ran an editorial endorsing the PC party in the federal election. And J.K. Irving, so that was on Saturday. J.K. Irving on Monday, the morning of the vote, had a front page letter to the editor saying, I disagree with the editorial board. I think the Chrétien government, Liberal government's on the right track, eliminating the deficit. And we've got, you know, we just went through this Quebec referendum, and let's not change horses in midstream, essentially, was the argument. So, you know, you can interpret that as having a very chilling effect on the editorial board for stepping out of line. Or you can interpret that as that's the way it should work. The editorial board obviously wasn't censored in advance in its endorsement. It obviously didn't go across his desk in advance. After he saw it, he disagreed with it, and he exercised his right very transparently to say, I disagree with the people who work at the newspaper I own.
I don't want to stand on propriety here, but it's bizarre for a paper to run a front page letter from its owner. I mean,
it's very unusual. I think in the 80s during the free trade debate, I think the Ottawa Citizen did something similar where the editorial board came out against free trade, and then the publisher, who basically was representing the owners of the paper, published something in response saying the company believes free trade is good, or something similar to that. I'd have to look that up to be sure. But no, it's extremely it's extremely rare.
And why I say they're disingenuous in saying, like, hey, look, we just want you to be a booster for the province is because in your interview with the Irvings about that, they basically admitted that that was not so much about what they thought was right for Canada, but that they were this close to some sort of massive deal.
And then he sort of stopped himself from getting into that discussion in mid-sentence.
And then you were cut off from further access, and then, in fact, a memo was circulated that no journalist was to speak with you.
Well, okay, I just want to get the order right. I went back to them after the interview months later to ask a bunch of I wasn't cut off as a result of that point. I went back to them months after the interview and said, look, in the course of the rest of my research, these other questions have come up, and I had a list of 20 things, some about the company, some about the family. At that point, they felt I was going into territory they weren't happy with, and they cut me off. The memo to the reporters happened even before the interview. Uh-huh. When I asked for an interview with Jamie Irving, who runs the papers day to day, he said no. And then that memo went out to the newsroom 2 weeks later saying, just a reminder, we don't talk on behalf of the company to outside publications.
What do you make of that as a journalist? I mean, this is, of course, something of particular interest to me. I buck up against any sort of like thin blue line mentality of like, you know, journalists who won't talk to journalists who won't, you know, provide the same level of, discussion about their field that we ask everybody else to provide in their field. So, you know, to receive that memo, I mean, you weren't an Irving employee at the time, but had you received that, what would you think about that?
Well, I'd obey it, right, for fear of losing my job.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I suppose if you're the employee of an organization and the employer is setting the policy and speaks for the company, there's a certain logic to that. Naturally, journalists are always trying to get employees of organizations they're covering to talk. So there is a bit of a dichotomy there for sure. And I mean, I would have loved for some of them to talk to me.
But no luck?
No luck. I mean, and you know what? I mean, I know a lot of them. I mean, I work side by side with them in the press gallery in New Brunswick, covering the government. I knew they would get in big trouble if they talked to me, and I didn't want to do that. And you know what? There were all kinds of other ways to get information.
Still, I mean, beyond just the lack of Google indexing and tweeting, you know, journalism has changed, and now the walls have come down between news organizations, and we're just constantly having conversations with each other on Twitter and elsewhere and sharing information and opinion.
Yeah.
And I don't see a lot of these journalists there.
No, I think one of the big problems with the paywall situation that they've established is they're out of the conversation. Like, I mean, you've seen stories get passed around, right? I mean, someone writes a story that's kind of novel or interesting, and boom, it just whips around Facebook and Twitter in a morning, and they're not getting that.
That's really useful because then you know it feeds into
Then people say, oh, this is an interesting newspaper, and I'm going to read more of this.
Or even other journalists say, you know what, I have something to add to that. Let me report another aspect or angle of that.
Yeah, totally. Now, I mean, where I work, we have an account, so I mean, I read the paper every day online. I'm not a generic example of the paywalled off news consumer, but it's an issue for them. They're not in the zeitgeist. There's no did you see that story in the Telegraph Journal today? Conversation that happens in New Brunswick,
which actually subtracts value for those journalists. You know, there is. I mean, maybe they're secure, and I don't know what the layoff situation is there like, but. But building your reputation amongst the profession on these social media platforms is an effective way that people stay employed.
Yeah, no personal brands there.
No personal brands.
Yeah.
What about, I mean, okay, so, you know, you reported this thoroughly with limited access. Perhaps more interestingly, you were able to publish it. Now, I'm aware the last big expose of a Canadian press baron may have been Bruce Livesey's book about Conrad Black, The Thieves of Bay Street. And Conrad Black sued him and sued his publisher.
Mm-hmm.
Sued him for libel for publishing testimony from his trial wherein he was convicted. Felony conviction. So there were lines in the testimony that were quoted in this book that were then subject. Well, that's libelous. Public record testimony.
Right.
And it's a suit that I can't imagine Conrad Black has any chance in hell of winning, but it's an incredibly effective slap to the publisher, and it's an incredibly expensive case to fight. And I've heard from people in the publishing business that since then, given the relatively low level of money that you're going to generate from a memoir of powerful families in Canada, that the appetite for running tell-alls or exposés or anything that could be construed as you know, vaguely negative towards powerful Canadians, there's not much of an appetite for it. So I'm curious how you got this published, and I'm curious what you weren't able to get in the book.
Well, how I got it published was Penguin agreed to publish it. And, you know, I approached this as a fair, even-handed journalist. So, I mean, there's criticism of them in there for sure. And I point out, I mean, there's no denying certain facts like the fact that they have not covered the story of the split. Right. Yeah. I mean, that's just – that's plain. But, you know, I also I quote them. I sought out their comments. I sought out all the family members that have been involved that are relevant to the story. I quote people in government who, you know, defend the government-Irving relationship. You know, I mean, that's like that's fair. I'm not trying to write a polemic, and I'm not trying to be an ideologue about this. I'm just trying to tell the story of how these papers have reflected their ownership. So,
well, look, truth and responsible communication are both accepted defenses to a libel charge, but they are not
absolute.
Well, they don't prevent you from getting sued.
Right.
They might prevent you from losing that case.
Right.
So, I mean, I wonder, well, first of all, are the Irvings as litigious as Lord Black? Have they launched many libel suits?
I don't think so. I don't think they launch, let's say that I'm not going to say that Black's lawsuit is frivolous, but I mean, I don't think the Irvings sue frivolously. Look, I did the best research I could, and I think it's a fair account.
Anything you couldn't get in there? Because I might put it on where Penguin wouldn't.
Not going to go there, Jesse. Well, here's an example. I looked at Arthur Irving's divorce file from 1980. It's like about 8 inches tall. Okay, it's 8 inches thick, and there's a lot of stuff in there about what led to the divorce and all that. I wasn't really interested in why Arthur Irving and his wife got a divorce. What I was interested in is what the file could tell me about his finances, his assets, any role in the newspapers and all that. So what I cite from the divorce file is what's relevant to the story, right? Which was this oddity that all the stuff in his house, his furniture, his antique car, his paintings, his carpets were all owned by the company.
Yeah.
Kind of curious. You know, you could ask whether that was to limit his obligations in a divorce case, but
you might even suggest that, but you wouldn't know it for sure.
Well, in fact, it did, because his lawyers argued against some of the things his wife was claiming, because it turned out that they weren't owned by him.
Right.
So that was the effect, whether it was intended or not. But I mean, I don't need to get into all this other stuff from the divorce, because that's not the kind of journalist I am, and it's not important to the story.
Sure.
But, you know, it's a public file.
The CBC is what's left in New Brunswick. The CBC is another voice for news there. Now, you work for the CBC, and
we're not going to talk about the CBC's direction.
We won't talk about the CBC's direction, but it seems like...
Only because, you know, it's my employer's policy that I'm not going to talk publicly about my opinions of the CBC's direction.
Okay. Can we talk, or I'll talk about it, and you'll fill in as much as you're comfortable saying. I think that there is a canary in the coal mine situation here, where when you essentially have market failure in terms of the market of information in a news market that's happened in New Brunswick, here is, you know, an irrefutable role for the CBC that is an essential role that is not about competing for music streaming or for sitcoms. I mean, this is something that isn't getting done.
Sure.
The business affairs of the Irvings is not getting covered. And there the CBC is, with money from the taxpayer to do so. Is there any kind of mentality that emerges, you know, in your shop there? Like, is that kind of like a hothouse situation where the sense of purpose and mission amongst the journalists at the CBC in New Brunswick could inform the rest of the CBC when similar trends are presenting themselves in other news markets where the privates are getting out of local news entirely or simply not doing it so well?
Oh, boy. I don't know. I mean, I'm not going to extrapolate the New Brunswick situation into other markets. I will say that given the scarcity of competition, media competition in New Brunswick, that's obviously an argument for a CBC that's doing its job, fulfilling its mandate in the province. I mean, in New Brunswick, we've got three local radio stations, CBC radio stations, with three local morning shows, which some people have said is a lot for a province of 750,000. But the counter argument to that is, when you've got one company running all these other newspapers, you really do need other robust media players in the market that are able to do certain kinds of stories, not because you set it up as your mission to go after a particular company, but because this is a company that's newsworthy and it's got to be covered, and it's important that we cover it.
And is there an open conversation amongst your colleagues there of like, look, let's direct ourselves to the things that are not getting talked about?
Well,
let's pick up the slack.
I'm not going to speak for my colleagues, but you know, the Irvings are a huge story in New Brunswick. You know, I mean, this year we've covered this decision by the province to give them these wood targets, this wood allocation that they want from public land, and we've covered that thoroughly, because it's an important story. So we have the ability to cover that story independently, and we do it.
Coverage of environmental stuff with the Irving family. How has that played out in their papers?
You know, it's funny. I mean, this is the nuance that I try to get across in the book, in that sometimes stories are covered and sometimes they're not. Over the years, when the story is so out there that it couldn't be ignored, it was covered, and other times there are stories that don't show up. So there was an incident with a heron nest that was damaged by some Irving logging operations that they didn't pay a great deal of attention to, you know. One of the things that happens is that sometimes it's not so much whether it's covered or not, it's the emphasis. I mean, there was an example in the book about there was some problem with one of the mills, and there was a coating of wood dust all over the city one day, but because of some problem with a filter or something like that. Well, the paper covers that because they can't not cover it.
Yeah.
On the other hand, you know, there were questions once about why they weren't covering pollution in the Bay of Fundy, and the editor said, well, we need something to react to. We need a protest or something, right? Like if there were a protest or something we could react to, then we would cover it. So that is the mentality that you've often seen over the years, is we're not going to go take the initiative ourselves to raise these questions.
That brings
up,
yeah.
But if something happens that is like that we have to react to in the street, well, then we would do it.
Well, then what good
are you? And that, you know what, that's a problem. That's a problem in other media organizations.
It is.
Too.
It's an interesting problem in media, is to what degree, and this is about advocacy journalism, I guess, is if you require somebody to make something public, and then you can kind of throw your hands up and say like, well, look, you know, we didn't break this. We're not causing a stink, but look, the protesters are on the street. Yeah. What are we going to do, not cover them? Is to kind of just abdicate your basic responsibility to say, well, this is of public interest.
But I don't even see that as advocacy journalism. You're not advocating anything there. You're describing the world as it is.
Yeah.
Like when they did this big enterprise series on the Bay of Fundy and did sort of they went to the Department of the Environment and they asked for the stats. How much effluent is gushing out of these pipes into the Bay of Fundy? And the Department of Environment turned over, you know, these stats of like whatever it was, thousands upon thousands of milliliters of gunk going into this ecosystem, and the newspaper published it.
Yeah.
That's not advocacy journalism. That's reporting. That's saying here is something that's happening, and we didn't just sit back and wait for it to hit us in the face, right? We went and asked the question.
I use the term loosely just simply as an advocate for the reader's interest and the reader's right to know.
Or an advocate,
not for a particular position.
Yeah, but. Or an advocate for, being based in reality.
Yeah. What's going to happen with their media empire? I mean, they seem to be standing in opposition of every trend.
They're standing in opposition to the trend, like you say, about getting it out there on social media and circulating it. But they're kind of – they might be ahead of the curve on figuring out a way to monetize it, again, acknowledging that they're kind of in a unique circumstance. But I don't know. I mean, I could see other media organizations looking to this paywall and saying, well, that's great that that's working for them. We should try that. But other media organizations, if they do that, may just send everybody to the competitor down the street.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I think their own internal newsletters, which I got access to, say they're preparing for a day when there won't be a print edition. They stopped making newsprint themselves in 2005. So, I mean, they recognized that newsprint was a dying market while still continuing to publish newspapers. But I think in terms of owning the asset, the media company, they're going to hang on to it. Why would they get rid of it? I mean, it may come back to the old argument, the old logic that Casey Irving had, that, you know, better we own it than someone else.
Haven't they, in essentially offering not the greatest product, as you describe it, and not a product that isn't doing some basic things that people in New Brunswick need from their media, and charging for it, haven't they created a perfect market condition for somebody else to step in, finally, to actually take them on?
Yeah, but who's going to do that now? Like, is Post Media going to launch a daily newspaper in New Brunswick? Doubt it. I don't know who would do that. I mean, every journalist in New Brunswick sort of daydreams about sort of the silver bullet, that some money's going to fall out of the sky and we'll launch this online thing that'll do this sort of serious in-depth coverage. But you know, how are you going to pay the bills with that? That's the question.
Thank you. It's a great read.
Thank you.
That is your Canada Land Show. I hope you liked it. You can always email me at jesse@jessebrown.ca. I'm on Twitter at Jesse Brown. The show's website is canadalandshow.com, and the crowdfunding site is patreon.com/CanadaLand. I make this show with Christopher DeMello, and the next episode of Canada Land Shortcuts will be up first thing Thursday morning. If you like this show, support it. Hey, I need you to pay close attention to this message. It is not an ad. This is about Canada Land, and this is about you. You need to know that the news crisis is about to get a lot worse. You've heard about the layoffs. We're about to have news closures. And it's very likely that we're going to be seeing the defunding of the CBC. Where are you going to get your information from? What can you do about this? You can support Canada Land. We need you to. And so for this month and this month only, you can become a Canada Land supporter and get everything our supporters get for just $2 a month. That is an almost 80% discount. The clock is ticking on this. It disappears at the end of the month, and then we will not offer it. We need your support. We need to keep news coverage alive in Canada. Go right now to canadaland.com/join. And thank you.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.